Today is Wednesday, February 5th, 2020. I'm Leslie McCartney, and we are here at the National Park Service, Bering Land Bridge National Preserve offices in Nome, Alaska. We have the pleasure of being with Katie Cullen, and today with Charlie Lean. And if you could just introduce both of yourselves, and then we'll get started.
Sure. I'm Katie Cullen. I'm the Interpretation and Education Program Manager here at Bering Land Bridge National Preserve, headquartered in Nome, Alaska.
Yes, I'm Charlie Lean. I'm a longtime fixture in Nome, a professional fisheries biologist, mostly retired these days.
So. Great. Were you born and raised here, Charlie? You said there's multiple generations of your family.
Yeah, so I moved to Nome at 3 months of age and left and 7 years later and returned when I was 28 and have lived here since 1981 at 28 to today. I'm 66.
And you said now that you have granddaughters, so you said you had four generations here or three generations?
Yeah, so my dad was here in World War II, and then my first 7 years, he was the mining engineer and then the civil engineer, first for the USSR&M, United States Smelting, Refining, and Mining Company, Alaska Gold or whatever you want to call it today, and then had a falling out with his boss and became the Bureau of Public Roads construction engineer for the Cougarock Road. So I was too young to really remember much of the mining residency, but I was a little kid in the construction camps on the Cougarock Road, and, you know, got into everything and caused all kinds of trouble. And then as a young man, I came back at 28 as a fisheries biologist for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. 20-year career with Fish and Game, managing drainages north of the Yukon in Alaska, and then sport fish, calm fish, subsistence. Then 5 years as the OSM subsistence fisheries manager for the same. And then 2005 or so, I went to work for NSCDC and became the director of fisheries research and development. And in the last 5 years, I'm semi-retired and just a thorn and a backseat driver for various fisheries outfits and also wildlife. I'm active with the advisory committee, the Western Arctic Caribou Herd Working Group, and stuff like that.
Right. So, and you mentioned you'd worked for the National Park Service,
I worked for the... So I was, as OSM manager, I was housed at the Park Service. Roughly 50% of my job was U.S. Fish and Wildlife managing fisheries, and roughly half was with the WARE, Western Arctic Parklands fisheries biologist. Mm. So I worked a lot in Kruzenstern and in Bering Land Bridge.
Right.
So and a little bit in Kobuk. Right.
So you've been here for a good chunk of time to see a good set of change, perhaps, if changes have occurred.
I have the benefit of my father's tenure as a gold miner from 1949 to 50, well, through my seventh year. So I have a pretty good perspective on stuff from 1949 on.
Great. So let's talk about similarities or differences in land.
Yeah. In the early 60s, moose were colonizing the Seward Peninsula. And it was lots of funny stories about moose. You have to remember the era. That was the era of the Project Chariot and using nuclear weapons for civilian purposes, right? Mm-hmm. So they were going to make a big port up at Red Dog area. And the Russians actually made a port on one of the rivers over there and have sterilized that river downstream of their port. But anyway, it was a real idea and very, very nearly came to pass. And my father was three kinds of an engineer, mining, mineral, civil. He was adamantly against it, and he would rant and rave. So I have some memories of my father's impressions. I mean, I was too young to really know anything. I just knew that Dad would froth at the mouth if I pushed a button. And so there was that. So, yeah, Dad grew up in Alaska as well, and I myself am a fourth-generation Alaskan. Mm. So Dad grew up eating moose meat in off-the-road system, Kenai Peninsula, and then... And so when moose came onto the Seward Peninsula, people were thinking that maybe they were irradiated horses. This was just at the time when horses ceased to exist in Nome. But in the 50s, there were still one or two horses in Nome that pulled wagons around and did delivery kind of jobs and stuff. And there was a whole, like half a block of horse-drawn wagons parked over in kind of behind where the community college is today, and that place smelled of horses for years, decades. And anyway, but that was, you know, we all knew what a horse was, but there was these moose, you know, and they looked like malformed horses to many people, and there was theories as why they looked like that, radiation being a big one, and my dad thought that was hilarious, and He saw moose as a very edible animal, you know, valued wildlife species. I draw the parallel of today's muskox issues to the moose of the 1950s. Mm-hmm. I don't like those things. They look weird. They eat funny stuff. They compete with me in the wild. Well, yeah, that's wildlife, right? Yep. So anyway, moose came onto the Seward Peninsula. Then in the early 80s, I was a young fisheries biologist flying surveys, and I watched the beaver sweep across the Seward Peninsula. So from 1982, I started flying in 81. 82 through the 90 or so, watershed by watershed, the beaver colonized across the peninsula. And then when the... They'd kind of eat themselves out of house and home, and then the population there, local population would collapse to about half to two-thirds of what it had been, and it's kind of leveled. And so now beaver are, they aren't at their peak, but they're numerous, mm-hmm. in my opinion. And relatively speaking, they're very numerous. Mm-hmm. So like, for instance, when, at the end of World War II, my father told stories about trying to make a living that first winter when he came back from the army and didn't have a employment. He went trapping with another guy, and the seasonal limit for a trapper was 2 beaver a year.
Wow.
Today it's unlimited.
Wow.
In comparison. So trapping was a real means of employment back then, but even at 2 beaver a year in 1947, that wasn't really enough to support a person,
mm-hmm.
you know, but it was better than going broke. So anyway, so beavers swept the Seward Peninsula. With beavers came big changes. What that did was it created overwintering ponds for coho salmon, juvenile kobo salmon, and it kind of, not related to beaver, but pink salmon blossomed in that neighborhood too, and we the combination of more pink salmon and overwintering habitat created silver salmon runs, and today in comparison to 1980 there's 4 times as many coho salmon on the Seward Peninsula as there was then. I'm not sure that the beaver expansion was climate change, but it was something. It was a major change. And I think the pink salmon was climate change. Pink salmon burgeoning. And they feed the young coho salmon. That's why that helps, too. We've also seen, like on the king crab, so through the 80s, commercial crabbers couldn't fish in much east of Nome, because the salinity of the Norton Sound was too fresh. King crab are absolutely intolerant of fresh water, and so if you bring them to the surface, they died. And you can't legally process, and there's good reasons for it, because spoiled crab is terribly poisonous. So everybody fished west of Nome. And then sometime in the early 90s, the salinity switched. It was driven because there was less shore-fast ice, and therefore less stratification in the water, and less fresh water being reserved until spring when the ice melted. Anyway, the salinity change resulted in an expansion of the crab population to the east, doubling the crab population, and creating opportunity for subsistence and commercial, and it was quite another big change, and very much climate driven.
And is it still like that today?
And so today we're having management issues. In fact, just today I was beating up Fish and Game for their poor management. Anyway, so not that I have any hard opinions, but anyway, yeah, so but salinity wise, yes, it's very much the same, and changing. Even now we're seeing temperature changes. Back then it was less temperature and more wind direction changes.
Water temperature or air temperature?
Air temperature now.
Air temperature.
And well, so air temperature drives the Alaska nearshore current, comes all the way up through the Alaska Peninsula, but gains a lot of mass in Bristol Bay, which is shallow and muddy and dark, and so Bristol Bay soaks up a lot of heat, and then that water comes running up the coast past the Kuskokwim and the Yukon rivers and their big deltas and the shallow areas, and then into Norton Sound, which is relatively shallow, and then around the point at Wales and into Kotzebue Sound, which is shallow, and it goes up beyond Point Hope, and in the neighborhood of Wainwright it goes offshore and creates a big bolus of warm water out in the middle of the Chukchi Sea. And so that has dramatically changed sea ice in the southern Arctic Ocean, Chukchi Sea, and it creates this big warm bolus of water that takes an extra month or two to warm or to cool in the fall, and delays the formation of ice, and is helping to wipe out the multi-year ice on the Arctic Ocean.
Mm-hmm.
But that's kind of the mechanics of it. So you see that year by year. I've listened to the weathermen and people, and they talk about how the average air temperature in the vicinity of the Arctic Circle, circumpolar, has gained 5 degrees Celsius on average here in the last few years, as compared to, say, the latitude of the continental U.S. Northern states, so like Seattle, Portland, Oregon, where they've gained 2 degrees.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, when it's just 2 degrees, 4 degrees Fahrenheit, people are kind of going, well, you don't think this is a real thing? I don't know. It's not that different from what I remember. I can tell you here in Nome, it's real different. A lot of people are, you know, it just depends what you take as your average. So the average for me is my lifetime. Younger people have a shorter average. I remember in my childhood, the bachelor's house on, you know, First Street down by just beyond the college. Two-story barn-shaped building facing the sea, and the seaward side being completely buried. And there was a rectangular hole in a snowdrift, and you walked into their entryway in their house. And the back of the house stuck out of the snowdrift, but they really had no light for months because they're buried. Their whole house, a two-story house.
Wow.
And I have another vivid memory. About 5 years of age, we were visiting somebody over, you know, up on the on First Street, not down by the mini convention, but one block back. And we were inside, and I'm a little kid. My mom's having tea with some lady, and I'm getting bored. And there's this noise outside. It's winter. It's dead of winter. It's twilight or dark. Twilightish. Late in the afternoon. And there's a sound like a locomotive rumbling outside. And we're all looking at each other. What's that? We go outside, and we're standing there on the street. And silhouetted on the horizon, you could see this pressure ridge building across the horizon. And the next morning, you know, it was more than 20 feet tall. A great big pressure ridge had formed from east to west. And it just sounded like a freight train at my grandparents' house in Oregon. I also remember these monster icebergs, you know, that'd be as big as a one-story house embedded in the otherwise flat, ice that had formed on Norton Sound. But those were multi-year icebergs that had come through the Bering Strait and ended up stranded on the beach here in Nome. And we would see these. And, I mean, they were frequent. I mean, they're not, you know, they're probably less than 5% of the ice mass out there, but there would be these blocks of ice that were monsters out there embedded in the ice.
Wow. When was the last time you saw something like that?
I left at 7 years old and I came back when I was 28, so...
Within that time.
Well, it was, you know, the early 60s.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And now today, I mean, just noticing here, it's February, and there's very little snow.
Yeah, that's... Last year there was a pile of snow, so I'm not sure that I would say that...
I was just thinking about when you said the house was completely covered, a two-story house.
So, but even last year, people were going, oh, this is like the top...
Oh.
This is definitely in the top five of snowfalls. I went, I don't think so. It depends what your frame of reference is.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
So last year was a snowy year, but it wasn't... It was above average,
mm-hmm.
but it was not a record. Mm. Nowhere close. And I remember running up on the one-story house that we lived on, getting on the roof and getting yelled at and getting chased off. Yeah, that was a common occurrence.
Can I just go back to the crabs? Because what you said was really interesting. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize that they needed a lot of salinity. So with less ice and a higher salinity, it's actually increased the area that you can
grab? Yeah. So the water under the ice out here right now is probably 34 parts per thousand,
mm-hmm.
and crab can tolerate fresh down to about 28 parts per thousand.
Hmm.
Your freshwater fish can tolerate 10 parts per thousand. That's roughly the equivalency of a fish's blood or a person's blood or a cow's blood or whatever. So if you're going to drown, you want to drown in 10 parts per thousand water. I'm getting off topic. But anyway, so when there's shore-fast ice, shelf ice, it's not just the ice that's stuck in place. There's these underwater freshwater springs that ooze up. And if you take a submersible or dive, it's like a curtain of slush in the places coming up. These seeps will be half a mile long, and there'll be a curtain of slush and comes up, and it freshwater floats on salt water, so it plasters itself to the bottom of the shelf ice. A good example of this is down at Hastings Creek, 8-10 miles east. The shore-fast ice always has a lobe that goes out around Hastings, because that's the fresh water causing the ice to be more thick. Because the salt water is at 28 degrees Fahrenheit.
Mm-hmm.
Fresh water freezes at 32, but salt water freezes at 28. So the, like in the fall, you can see the viscous fresh water floating on the choppy salt water.
Mm-hmm.
That's that freezing differential manifesting itself out there. So anyway, that's what happens. So you get this big accumulation of fresh water. And also the saltwater ice, when it freezes, it precipitates out all the salt. It helps solidify, that's not a word, make it more salty below. And, you know, on fresh, brand new fresh sea ice, if you scooped the the hoarfrost off the top and taste it, you just pick out your tongue. It's super salty. Anyway, salt, more salt that was in the ice falls, it gets real salty. And so the crab go, oh, hey, I haven't been there in a long time. They come inshore and they find food resources that they were unavailable to them during the summer months when wind is mixing the freshwater layer with the salt water layer, and you get something less than 28 parts per thousand clear out to minus 30 feet. That's a mile offshore. So crabs just don't even come in close. Plus, anything less than 20 feet gets scoured by ice and torn up and plowed. There's not a lot of food value in little tiny animals. They want to rather eat big stuff. So, yeah, but anyway, when we had more shore fast ice, we had this big layer of fresh water that lasted sometimes well into July. And so when the crabbers brought the crab up through the fresh water, they all died. There were crab at 40 feet, but they had a real low ceiling. They couldn't go too far inland or else they'd get poisoned.
So now people can crab closer to shore?
So in the winter, when it's well below freezing, then all the fresh water gets taken up in ice. And so it's salty and the crab are there. And then when it starts to flirt with freezing, in late March, that's when crabs start to move offshore. Mm-hmm. There's places like Port Clarence where it's kind of a basin, mm-hmm. and a few unlucky crab get caught in the basin, mm-hmm. and then the ceiling comes down and they're trapped, and over the summer mixing and stuff, and they die a slow death, mm-hmm. of freshwater poisoning in the center of Port Clarence.
I did not know that about crab. So that's really interesting. Yeah. Thank you.
So other climate change things I've seen are more geologic, I guess. Mm-hmm. I'm as a young man in Southeast Alaska and stuff, I worked as a land and road surveyor. Mostly road surveyor and road inspector. My dad was a road engineer for a big part of his life. He was the head BIA road engineer in Alaska, so you name the community, dad built a street there, a road or something. So got lots of broad perspective on road building. So it's real interesting for me to read reports of like when they built the Seward Peninsula Railroad, mm-hmm. and some of those, or I have some of my dad's notebooks from when they built the Cougarock Road, and the issues they encountered, and the permafrost was so close to the surface, and gee, you didn't want to, they didn't have to do much to insulate the road to keep it frozen beneath, and today, big sections of the road are falling off the hillside, and things are liquefying, and pingos have ceased to exist. Do you know what a pingo
is?
Yes,
I do.
So there used to be a number, in the 80s on the Seward Peninsula, the pingos were you can drive the Cougarock Road and see 20 of them.
Oh.
And today, maybe find one, and mm-hmm. it's all collapsed. It's just the remnants of a pingo.
Right.
And so, here in the last couple of years, if you drive out to the Cynic River, or if you drive north of Salmon Lake, you will find where the hillsides are just collapsing. And a little further out in the flat, you can see what had been frost polygons. Mm-hmm. Now they're frost islands, surrounded by a trench with water in it.
Right.
And on the gentle slopes just north of the Kuzitrine River Bridge, used to be able to, I'm getting older, but used to be able to bounce along and go berry picking out off the road, miles. And now it's bisected by 6 and 8 foot deep trenches with a mud bottom and sometimes running water. You know, and I'm afraid to put my foot in there. I might get quicksanded away, you know. It's a gooey mess.
Yeah.
And it's shocking to me how that just seemed to happen over about a 2 year period. And I guess the tipping point was reached where the average temperature was above freezing in the soil. It just went away. I can say that my subdivision, I live in Icy View here in Nome, suffering very, very similar related problems, you know, with many of my neighbors and I complained bitterly August through November about how our house was shifting into level at every 2 weeks. It's just crazy, you know. The pilings were pumping up and down and nobody could, you know, sheetrock was cracking and I just painted the damn thing and it's all cracked up again. It's very frustrating.
Yeah, very. Yeah. And every year this is happening.
Yeah, it breaks sewer mains and water mains.
Right.
And it's hard on houses and it's just, it's a mess. And in my lifetime, I've seen places that were blueberry patches turn into over my head willow patches that have copses of cottonwood. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite things is to go look for quaking aspen. It's like an Easter egg hunt. I can tell you 3 or 4 places where quaking aspen are that nobody thought they lived. Anyway, but you're seeing these plants that require their roots to be in thawed ground taking off. White spruce, cottonwood, balsam poplar, same thing, and quaking aspen are all getting a foothold here. And, you know, maybe in my granddaughter's lifetime, there'll be a little forest.
Right. Well,
just like there is right behind the jail where the mining artificially thawed the ground.
Mm.
And today there's 20-foot tall cottonwoods.
Mm. You mentioned you're on the board with the caribou.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about any changes that you've seen in the caribou? Perhaps migrations or where they're going?
Well, it's difficult to do the cause and effect.
Mm-hmm.
But so with the understanding that caribou are in roughly a 50-year cycle, so every 50 years they're at a high and every 50 years they're at a low. And right now we're just coming off a low. I think we're about a year beyond the low, but my glass is half full. I don't know how yours is. Right now caribou are kind of scarce, and there's not a lot of back pressure to force them to migrate. So I think they've pulled back a little bit on their migration. In addition, as I mentioned, you know, the tundra breaking up and causing these trenches and so forth, that is an impediment for them. The other impediment is that the vegetation change. So caribou are very dependent on lichen, especially in the winter. And so when lichen just don't, you can burn up lichen and kill them that way, but basically lichen are there and big trees can come up through lichen and there'll still be lichen. But they kind of get shaded out eventually. If you read about the 1920s and 30s when the Northwest Arctic caribou herd was in a high, you'll also read about massive migrations crossing the Yukon that shut down steamboat traffic for days at a time.
Wow, on the rivers.
On the Yukon River.
Yeah.
And that herd doesn't reach the Yukon River anymore. Hasn't reached there in 100 years. And so I think that's a climate-driven change. I think that's vegetation, because talking with people in Galena a few years ago, they were telling me how, it used to be all blueberries over, now it's all black spruce, just, you know, dog hair thick, it's terrible. Hard to get around in there. Stuff like that. And I don't doubt that at all. My grandparents told me about the transition from caribou to moose on the Kenai Peninsula. And that was caused by a fire, much like last year's fire on the Kenai. But so it probably was a combination of fire and climate change. And we're seeing I have a lot of theories about caribou. So the Sheldon Jackson, 1870, was a well-meaning missionary that brought reindeer to the Seward Peninsula. And that herd eventually was multiplied and grown. And he spread reindeer all the way to Bristol Bay to Barrow. And they were very proud of themselves. And, you know, they did that because in the 1870s, the caribou had crashed, and there were no more caribou on the Seward Peninsula, and they make these wild claims that, oh, they're extirpated. Poor people are going to starve to death, and people were starving to death. Not to belittle that. I mean, that's the interior Seward Peninsula people's apparently migrated to Unalakleet. I know individuals that told me about their parents and grandparents' migration. So, I believe that. But, be that as it may, I believe that the reindeer displaced the very few caribou that were left on the Seward Peninsula. And I think the caribou of the Seward Peninsula were a satellite herd, very much like the herd up by Barrow, the Teshapuk Lake herd, which is a satellite herd. And then there's all these other herds across the central Arctic and the eastern Arctic herds and blah blah blah, and they're all genetically related. They all look the same. I mean, if I put one of those next to the
porcupine caribou, you'd
not know. There's woodland caribou and there's barren ground caribou, and the barren ground caribou are interbred and genetically the same, really. So the reindeer that came from Norway would be about as genetically different as you could get as a caribou. And they put them here, and in my childhood, the reindeer of the Seward Peninsula were monsters. And there's still some big guys out there. I mean, they're hybrid vigor, thriving, huge animals. That's not reindeer. Sorry. I mean, yeah, it might be 80% reindeer, but they mixed with the caribou, and that's why they're genetically vital and so healthy. And, and as a biologist, there's a credibility gap. I believe what happened was that the reindeer herds were predominant, and the reindeer herders were conscientious zealots. Maybe zealots not the right word, but conscientious, hardworking people that, in any animal that resembled a reindeer, was herded, and even if it became a problem and tried to run away all the time, it took a year or two before they made that determination and terminated it. And so they introduced this mixture, and they basically assimilated the wild caribou. And now we're having trouble with the Northwest Arctic herd coming down and the reindeer running away with. And maybe there's a lot of people that think, oh, they just don't make it. You know, they can't keep up with those animals. Well, some do. Some don't. But to me, it's we basically decided to call some caribou wild and some tame. And it's, I'm not saying that's good or bad socially. That's just what happened.
Interesting.
And so you have to look at where the range of reindeer are, as well as where the official Northwest Arctic herd is. What I can tell you is when I started flying surveys in the 80s, there were 100-year-old caribou tracks all over the headwaters of the Unalakleet River And only twice in my memory have caribou crossed the Unalakleet to the south. There are reindeer down there at Stebbins and St. Michael. But, and some of them get away and they get shot on the Yukon, and the Yukoners and the Stebbinsites are mad at each other about that. But anyway, there's caribou are pulling back further and further north. They've in the last 100 years have barren ground caribou no longer get close to the Yukon. Woodland caribou have intruded to the interval between where the barren ground abandoned, and now there's woodland caribou on the east side of the Nolato Hills, all the way up almost to the Kobuk drainage. And there's a little mixing, but I mean, a little overlap of range, but I don't really believe that there's much mixing between woodland and barren ground. And I think if you did some genetic sampling, you'd find that. So, I hear that on the North Slope, even there, and on the definitely on the Kobuk, we're seeing the same kind of permafrost meltdown that we saw here on the Seward Peninsula. And I think the jury's still out what's happening there.
Right. And what are your thoughts on the changes? And I've only heard, I don't think I've heard the full kind of story about changes at Onion Portage with the herds crossing through that area. And in the past couple of years, right, there have been some changes in timing potentially and or...
Well, definitely timing change is going on. And so there's... On the fall migration, you know, the southern migration, the upper Noatak is just a... 20 years ago, it was just a winter desert. You know, just brutal. And caribou that stayed there did not prosper. They might have survived, but they didn't. That wasn't a good place. And then they would flow through all those passes between the Kobuk drainages and the Noatak. And so they kind of walked down the Noatak towards Kelly Lake area. And then they flow through all those passes into the upper Squirrel River, the Kobuk, I mean the Salmon, and what's the next river? Salmon. Anyway, Kobuk Valley National Park area. And they would flow through there, and then they, you know, the winter was kind of chasing them, and they would, you know, I can remember in the 80s, I used to hunt at Clary Creek, and hunted at Onion Portage, and my dad hunted there in the 40s, and then they would push, but they were on a mission, and the herd was coming and coming. I can remember being there, and then one day it just stopped. They'd pass me. They were all gone, and the weather was right. You know, the next day there was a snowstorm, and I just barely got out of there. I had to wait 2 days for an airplane to come in, and I just, I mean, we risked life and limb to get out of there, to get to Cayenne. And anyway, so life's much gentler these days, you know. Freeze thaw, who knows, maybe. So then the caribou kind of mill around in the Kobuk Valley, and they're very susceptible to human disturbance, probably more so than they used to be, because they were on a mission back then, and now you go down to the Kobuk, and geez, there's a bunch of boats, I'm going to go back, you know. And they kind of worked their way upstream, and Onion Portage has become, on some years, the place to be, and other places, other years, it's like there's too much people here, too. And there's not... Last year, there was... more than 50% of the herd overwintered in the Kobuk Valley.
Wow.
So, no biggie. I'll just stay north of the river. You know, don't have to risk life and limb. So, whether that's a food choice or a human disturbance choice, I'm not sure. I think some of both. I should talk about salmon since I'm a fish biologist.
Sure, talk about. I was just going to say. So I just took just before we go off the caribou. So you said they were on a mission before, and the cold weather was right behind them. But now they might stay. You said, you know, maybe human, maybe food, but maybe too, because that cold
weather
isn't
not,
coming at them.
There's not as much pressure.
Right. Interesting.
And I mean, even 10 years ago, there was a big bunch of caribou that died up near Kivalina. Between Red Dog and Kivalina, and they tried to overwinter in those hills west of Point Hope, I mean east of Point Hope, and that's terrible country in the winter too.
Mm.
Been up there and doing science projects in the bitter of winter, and it's bitter, just horrible.
Mm.
So,
interesting.
Anyway.
So salmon, you said something earlier that
So in my lifetime, I watched pink salmon colonize in Kotzebue Sound.
Hmm.
And so in the 90s, there was a lot of, well, I got hired originally by Fishing Game to locate a salmon stock significant enough to support commercial fishing between the Yukon and Unalakleet. So some of my early 80s work was on the Pikmiktaalik and south of Stebbins, Nunatak, Pikmiktaalik, Kuyak, those streams. And those were chum salmon streams, and there were no beaver. And there was one or two kings, but mostly it was chum, no pinks. 10 years later, there's beavers all over the place. The chum run was reduced by half. The pinks had shown up. A combination of beaver and pinks had outcompeted the poor little chums. And the silvers started. And today, those are silver streams. Pinks and silvers. So, and just a couple chum.
So explain to me what the beaver dams have done in order to make that environment.
So these are gently sloping streams with not that much volume. So they... When the spring flood happens, they're not big enough to blow a beaver dam. It just overtops the dam, but the beaver dam persists. So it's not a barrier for out-migration. It's a barrier for incoming adults. And the other thing, you know, so pink salmon, if they get a run at it, can jump 18 inches vertically. And a chum, 2 feet.
Hmm.
And a red salmon, 5 feet. And the king salmon, a lot. And a silver, in the order of 5 feet, too, also. And so those pinks and chums are just not adapted to go over beaver dams. So beaver is an effective barrier for those adult salmon. Not so much for reds and silvers. And kings prefer a different kind of water. They're big river fish, and so they're not so much affected by beavers either. But they are affected by those piranha-like silver smolts. So silver fingerlings eat anything that moves. They are voracious.
Hmm.
They eat anything. And they're the reason that the grayling here, Nome, have declined. They're the reason that the chum down there have declined. They're voracious.
Hmm.
So the pink seem to, I should also say that chum salmon have the best eggs of any salmon. So if you're a Japanese person that likes your caviar roe, the chum salmon is the top quality roe, the best, far and away. They have a great big yolk sac, which means they're really well adapted to cold water situations and much, much better than any other salmon. And Dolly Varden have a different strategy. They have little tiny eggs, and they just hatch immediately, get laid, pop.
Oh.
So they can handle the coldest water of all the salmonids. So the Arctic slope used to be populated by char, Arctic char, Dolly Varden, and even in the 80s, the many streams out by Kivalina, that, you know, they were not salmon streams at all. And then, so that's changing. So just 2-3 years ago, I had a colleague, a young woman that's getting her PhD. She worked in Nome for a number of years, then she was from Canada. She went back to Winnipeg, and she's working for DFO, Department of Fisheries and Oceans. And she's the Arctic fish biologist for the McKinsey. Mm-hmm. And she started sending me pictures of salmon. What kind of salmon is this? What kind of salmon is that? And the people up here are really angry that these damn things are getting in the way of their dollies, their char.
Yeah.
Because they're char people, and they don't like salmon. It's just the opposite. Here in Norton Sound, people, the dollies eat all the salmon. They're going to kill them all. You know? So it was funny for me to see the complete flip.
She must be working up in the Delta, because that's where the char and the dolly varden are, because I used to live up there.
Okay. Yeah. Well, she said they're just...
Yeah.
She said last year there was more salmon than there if you combine the previous 20 years.
Wow.
So, and then I've heard that, you know, 10 years earlier, I heard that in Barrow. That same kind of statements, and watch the salmon colonize that way. And I one of the funnier moments in the late 80s, I was managing the salmon fisheries in Kotzebue, and had gone through a really skinny period with salmon, and I was very well known as a fisheries biologist and not very well liked, but I was what they had, you know. And so I would... One night, I was working late, it's like 6 o'clock, and I'm plowing through my paperwork, and I get this phone call, and it's this guy, and he's just, the Red Dog mine's killed everything! There's fish dying everywhere! It's horrible! It's horrible! And really, what, you know, and so where? Give me exact locations, you know. So jumped in a plane that night, got the fish and wildlife officer up, drug him out. We gotta go look, you know, it's summer, so it's daylight. We flew up there, and and it was a pink salmon run senescing. You know, the pinks had spawned and they were dying. And yeah, there was a lot of dead fish and it smelled bad. But that's life. And I had to go back and explain in Kivalina, no, it wasn't the mine. That's just how it is. But they didn't know that salmon died like that.
Mm.
That was a new thing.
And is that because the water is warmer, or
no,
is
salmon,
it just
pink salmon, had colonized? They're used to seeing dollies that are multi-year spawners. Right. They come in, they go out, and when all these fish died, it was like, oh my God, what happened?
Right.
Well, salmon just spawned once, and that's it.
Yeah.
And they didn't. They probably knew that on an academic level, but they didn't know that it was a new thing.
So why are the salmon coming in then if it's a new thing? That's, I guess, my question. If it was cold water...
Because there were more and more... The first place I really noticed a lot of pink salmon was at Fish Creek on the north side of Kobuk Lake.
Mm-hmm.
And they really took off there. And, then, you know, there's a few pinks here and a few pinks there in lower Kobuk and lower Noatak, Fish Creek, and other places on the north side of the Seward Peninsula. Over by Candle, there were some pinks, Buckland, a few, but there was chums. Everybody was, chum were the bread and butter fish, everybody, you know, the kala, the good stuff, you know, and then you, I don't even know what the word for pink is, you know, Lots of you guys don't have a word for pink. Yeah, it was, and then, you know, in the 90s, the only coho salmon I was aware of, there was a small run on the Kugruk River near Candle, way at the headwaters where it came out of the hillside from just north of Granite Mountain. There was a little run of silvers up there. But there was only chums. You know, there's like, the north side of the Seward Peninsula has a genetically distinct weird chum. Mm. So like at Deering, that chum run is genetically unique. Mm. They're short and deep and funny looking. and you probably are inbred. I mean, they almost got wiped out, and then they came back. So, I mean, it's just a funky-looking chum.
Oh.
And, you know, the Kotzebue no-attack or Kobuk chum are beautiful fish. Big, robust, super firm, just way better than Norton Sound fish.
Hmm.
But yeah, those Deering fish, the Imichuk fish are just weird.
I guess I'm still not understanding when you were talking about the salmon coming where the Dolly Varden and the trout used to be. What's bringing them in now if they traditionally haven't been in those waters? Or have they always been there but just not as
so the,
big a variety, big amount?
So there's the salmon have to run quite a bit south in the winter to get to a place where they can feed. So they have to be south of the ice edge.
Mm-hmm.
So part of it is the length of the season before the ice forms.
Okay.
So there's at the mouth of the Mackenzie or someplace like that, the mouth of the Colville,
mm-hmm.
That stream pumps out a bunch of kind of warm water, a lot of nutrients. Little baby fish come down the river, juveniles, and they go out and they have something to feed on. And then they have a really long stretch before they can find more feed. And so in the past, I think what limited it was, you just didn't have the stamina to go further south to get home. But first, of course, you know, the Kotzebue Sound is very similar to Norton Sound, temperature-wise. A little bit smaller, but not much smaller. And in about a month less summer than Norton Sound.
Okay.
So those, you know, pink salmon, combination of pink being abundant in Norton Sound and pressure to colonize further north, and then finding a nice Alaska nearshore marine current coming up. So kind of a pipeline of warm water to follow and take you north and take you south too.
Mm.
So all that. And then but yeah, the fact that they've made it all the way to Mackenzie is really noteworthy. Last fall was a very mild fall up on the north slope, to the point they couldn't get to the ice mass, you know, during whaling season.
Mm-hmm.
So that's those fish had all the time in the world to make it south.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Who knows? Maybe they'll turn east and end up on Hudson River.
Mm. So you said down in the rivers where the beavers have really been damming up, that the chums haven't been able to get as far up because you said they can only jump a couple of inches.
Yeah.
So how are the numbers then? I mean, they're not getting up river to spawn properly then?
Right. So the chum populations are half of what they were 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah.
In those smallish rivers that don't have the volume to blow the dam. On larger streams, you know, Fish River, Nome River, there's just enough volume to clear the system. And so the beavers have to rebuild every year and they don't get ahead of it. But down there on the Piedmont streams of the, you know, north of the Alaska Peninsula, there's a coastal plain, a very extensive coastal plain, and the beaver dams are 8 feet tall. I mean, they just can't. And there's some beaver dams like that on the headwaters of the Fish River that, you know, only a silver could jump.
Hmm.
They're a barrier.
Castles.
Yeah.
Wow. Hmm.
So, and it, by impounding the water and the beaver dams, it provides good overwintering habitat, but it kind of allows the water to cool down. And so it actually can, like if you go to the Penny or Cripple River this time of year, you'll find that those rivers are almost frozen at the mouth. There's alf ice fields upstream of there where the ice is, the river's frozen to the bottom, the water's running up on top, and then it freezes and makes these big ice patches.
Mm-hmm.
So the beaver dams may have even limited the lower river spawning places on a few occasions.
I know Katie's mentioned, and other people have mentioned, that beaver dams are also changing the area around the Serpentine hot springs. Have you?
Yeah, so I wrote a paper on that right before the beavers got there.
Oh.
And then who knows where it went? Ken's desk. But anyway.
What was your paper about?
I wrote a paper about the fishes of Serpentine at the request of the park superintendent. And it was, I don't know where it went. It's vaporized. But
so you were raising a concern about the fish there,
no,
then?
No, he wanted he was going to make it was Dave Spurdy's, and he wanted to have like a brochure to hand out to visitors so that he could go look at there's Alaska blackfish and pond smelt and grayling and different things that were in there. And he wanted kind of a little fish ID book to, a page or so of biology about that fish and why it was unique. Just, something kind of an activity for people to do while they were poking around.
So have you been up there recently at all to see the changes that have happened? I mean, certain people have said.
No, I was there a couple years ago in the winter. Haven't had occasion to go there in the summer. Too much work.
I've never been to Serpentine in the wintertime. When you've been in the winter, have you noticed, and I guess I'm not familiar with different beaver activity that might be happening in the wintertime as opposed to...
Oh, they're all under the... There's nothing to see.
They
when you go over a beaver dam in the fall, you'll see a big house, big dam. And then you'll see right next to the house, usually between the dam and the house, a bunch of green branches, twigs sticking out of the water. That's their food pile for the winter. So if you're a beaver trapper in the winter, you put a trap right between the house and the food pile. That's where you catch them. But they come out of their house, go over, grab something, go back. And they're not good housekeepers. You know, it's cold. So they don't. They drag twigs over and chew on them in their house. And it's not uncommon at all for them to plug up their house and have to chew their way out in the spring. They're kind of dumb. Anyway, so that's why beaver houses continue to grow and grow and grow and get huge, is because they're bad housekeepers. That's my opinion.
Interesting.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I was always curious, since especially, with the hot spring right there, if that might change, potential winter beaver activity or kind of how...
So, yeah, a beaver is really, really a strong swimmer. You know, it's an aquatic animal. It's made to be underwater. It's meets a lot like a seal meat. It's got all kinds of hemoglobin, and it's really dark. If you eat it, it tastes like a seal, like real high iron content. But on land, they're just helpless. They have horrendously vicious teeth. Beavers' teeth are way long, but they just aren't maneuverable. And so on land, even a fox probably could take a beaver out. Otters win most of the time. Otters eat beaver. There are otters that specialize in beaver eating.
Really? I did not know that.
So that's another thing that nobody talks about. But
these are the land otters or sea otters?
Land otters are voracious. They're pretty tough customer.
Is there a big population of them up on the Seward Plains?
Yes. And so the otters, I've seen otters miles from any water in the winter, on the top of the snow, bouncing along, apparently hunting ptarmigan. And they see me coming and they just dive in the snow and like an earthworm into the snow. And you can sit there and wait and wait and wait and just You can hear him chattering at you down there, mad, but he's not going to come out.
So if they eat beavers, their population sort of...
otters have been numerous for a long time, and people just aren't aware. But there's been otters around for... They used to be a source of income for subsistence trappers. There's not too many subsistence trappers anymore. But otters have been around longer than the beaver.
I didn't realize that.
A lot longer.
Thinking about fish, and I got to wondering what initially got you interested in becoming a fish biologist?
Money.
Oh.
So as a, in high school, well, even before, I was a very outdoorsy kid, and I just lived to hunt and fish and run through the woods. In high school, I was a mediocre high schooler. I was okay, but not a great student, kind of a jock. I didn't know what I wanted to do. Vietnam War was going, and I was going to get drafted. It was a guaranteed thing. I was going to get drafted. And so I went to college without a plan, and I took biology courses. I told everybody I was a pre-med student just to get my dad off my back, but I didn't have any intention of being a doctor. Anyway, so I took biology classes, and the fish and the wildlife classes were the same for the first 2 years. And by middle of my second semester, the Vietnam War shut down. I'd gotten my notice to go get my physical and in preparation for entering the Army, but then they changed their mind and turned me loose. And there I'd been kind of partying and goofing off. It was the beginning of the pipeline, and again, I wasn't a very good student. So there I was. The plan seemed more imperative. So I went for wildlife management. I got a degree in wildlife management, Bachelor of Science. There were no jobs. And my grades weren't such that I could get a scholarship, and I didn't have any more money. And so I got a job as a fish biologist in Bristol Bay with Fish and Game. Did that for a number of years. Became disenchanted and thought that nobody was ever going to hire me, and poor me. And that fall, when I was working seasonally, worked like 6-7 months a year, then go trapping or do something in the winter, drive trucks, whatever I did to get by. And then they told me, I went in and they said, "Are you coming back next year?" And I said, no, time to grow up and do something. Then I get a job. And they looked at me kind of funny. Said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, nobody's hiring me." "What are you going to do?" "Oh, I know I can get a job driving trucks or whatever." And I went about my business for the day. And an hour or two later, the two bosses came up to me and, "Come in here." And gave me a whole page full of names and places to talk to. "One of these guys is going to give you a job, Charlie." Boogers had not told anybody that I was looking. So anyway, I was mad at him. A couple of weeks later, I went into the office at Anchorage Fish and Game, and first guy I visited offered me a choice of three jobs. So I ended up in Nome. I had a choice: Nome, Bethel, or St. Mary's as a assistant manager. An entry-level biology job. And took the Nome one. The guy was impressed that I'd actually lived here before and knew what I was getting into, so I got the job. And then my predecessor, his marriage fell apart, and he left, and they had to hire somebody. So, so I've been here ever since. Yeah. Yeah.
So when you worked for the Park Service here, what were your what was your responsibilities when you were with the Park Service?
So then I did my 20-year. I was also a peace officer, you know. I had a 20-year police retirement, and I realized that fishing game, I'm working half time. You know, they pay me half. If I retired, they'd give me half my paycheck out. So I started looking for a new job. That was right when the federal subsistence controversy happened, mm-hmm. you know. And so Fish and Wildlife Service was hiring all these fishing game guy, high-time fishing game people to do their subsistence management. So U.S. Fish and Wildlife didn't really have an office in Nome, but they wanted to put somebody in Northwest Alaska. So they contacted the Park Service. Park Service said, well, we'll house that person if you pay half their salary or expenses. So Park Service did that. And Spurdy's wanted me to move my family and everything to Kotzebue, and I refused. And he stalled, and I started looking again, and when he heard I was looking again, he hired me.
So did you get up into the Bering Land Bridge Preserve? Yeah.
I had been already, you know. Yes. I've flown all those streams many times, and so Kotzebue and Norton Sound were my fish and game responsibilities, and I'd already been everywhere. That's one of the reasons they wanted to hire me, is because mm-hmm. there's no learning curve. I just, yeah. Do you want me to name that fish? You know, I know that one. Yeah. So, yeah. So I did. Yeah. So I the things I did in Bering Land Bridge for the Park Service was first thing I did was write that paper on fish at Serpentine.
Did it ever get published? Or no.
No.
Nope.
Well, then Spurdy's left, and then he died. Hmm. And then one of the high priorities for this in Krusenstern, Bella in Krusenstern, was the lack of knowledge about fish and marine stuff. So they said they needed to do an inventory. And at first it was just a species count, but then it turned into a population estimate of all these species.
A species just of the park or of the whole Seward Peninsula?
Of the park. Of the park units.
Yeah.
So nobody's done that yet.
Oh, so it was supposed to species and then it was going to be a count.
Well, first they changed their mind and then they cut my funding when I started.
Okay.
So it never happened.
So it's never been done. So there's no baseline to even judge things by.
Well, so there was a few voucher specimens and things. I found those, and at least two of them were misidentified. You know, they had a pike skeleton, or a burbot skeleton identified as a pike, and a red salmon that was really a chum salmon and stuff. So, anyway, so there were some mistakes. I tried to correct those. Got nowhere. No skin off my nose. So, anyway, there's mistakes in the inventories that they have. But I went up and I spent several days on Imrik Lake, on Krusenstern Lake, and then I did winter surveys of a whole bunch of smaller lakes all over Bella, and went, you know, assessed them as to how badly they froze down. Was there oxygen sufficient in the lake to support fish over the winter? Was there, you know, what was the rough size of the winter thawed water mm-hmm. versus the summer water and stuff. And again, I don't know where all that went, but I did it. And I could, from memory, I could tell you some interesting things. There was a glacial relic population of Dolly Varden, not Dolly Varden, Arctic Char, and Krusenstern Lake on the southern tributaries to Krusenstern Lake, little tiny Arctic char that look more like a bullhead, and they, because they're so inbred, and they're sexually mature at about 5 inches.
And they can't migrate in or out because they're in this lake.
They can migrate out, but they'll never be back.
Okay.
Yeah, they go splat when they go off the falls.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we found a few of them stranded and petrified on the. It was a dry summer that year. And Imrik Lake was really interesting, but they had snails and grayling. And the grayling were heavily parasitized because there's a tapeworm parasite that utilizes those two species as in, you know, a juvenile and a adult form. And so they, a bunch of really nasty looking grayling and no other kind of fish. But Kusatrin Lake had like 6 species for a lake that's so small. That kind of indicates that at one time it was a much larger lake and was probably connected by waterway to sea. And that the stream is, you know, eroded and marched back, and it's created all these little canyon and waterfall situation where it's, you can see that the lake is shrunk to half its size.
And it must be very rich in nutrients if it can support 6 different species. Was there a big population of them, or?
I didn't try to do the population part.
Right.
But it was, there were enough that we caught them, no problem. So, I mean, there's people do occasionally go fishing there. It's a pretty spot, and it's historically really significant, you know. A lot of 200-year-old caribou Eskimo culture kind of stuff going on. There's cairns and tent platforms and just, you know, great huge areas covered with cracked marrow bones.
Hmm.
Just caribou bones 6 inches deep for as big as a gym floor places. And a couple of World War II relics up there, too. It was kind of fun to poke around. And I took a park ranger and I, and we did a patrol of the winter patrol. The Great Circle of the Bering Land Bridge. So, and as we went, I drilled holes in a bunch of lakes and depth find and you know, mapped depth and oxygen. And at least on one, we must have seen a fish go by the depth finder because this blip went horizontal instead of vertical. I was like, that's something. Yeah. Don't know what it was, but it was something live.
Yeah.
And then a couple lakes that looked promising that weren't, you know, that froze to the bottom and were hopelessly dead.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So. And do these, you said these results, they didn't get published anywhere? Or
no, I have some of my scratch work buried in a file someplace of my own, but I Ken was my supervisor, so when I left, I gave him all that stuff and walked out the door.
Interesting. So do you get up in the area much more?
Rarely. I mean, occasionally on a snow machine. But, yeah, that's kind of on the edge of my range as far as caribou hunting goes or something like that.
Yeah.
I'd like to go to the Good Hope River Cottonwood Camp. And Serpentine's okay, but I don't like a bunch of people, so so I try to figure out when nobody else is there if I go, which is the most bitter time of the winter.
Right.
It's very spacey to go take a snow machine over the hill into Serpentine, and as you crest the low ridge separating that from the rest of the Serpentine, that valley where the hot springs are is just filled with fog, and it's cold out. It's like, it's a bit of a leap of faith, you know, you drive up to the edge and you can see these trail markers going down into the soup, and you really can't see more than 100 yards, and it's like, I guess. Go down, it's pretty steep going down. You go in there, and you're, in no time you're right there at the buildings, and you know, park my snow machine on a FOD spot, and then I throw a tarp over it, because if you don't, it, in the morning it's that deep in frost.
Right.
And you, little pain to start. And and if you tarp it, then it kind of, you don't have to heat it or anything to get it started, because it can be 40 below easily.
And the hot springs don't freeze over because they're
the ground. The thermal, even the ground, is there's, you know, it's not just a place where the water comes up. It's,
yeah,
it's all a over. Biggish area. The building was, the original bunkhouse was built on a hot spot.
Oh.
And that's why it rotted out so often. Because all the steam constantly perking through the building.
Right.
But, and then just a half mile away is the Arctic Spring. Maybe covered in a beaver dam by now. But that was, when I worked for the Park Service, I went down there and opened that up a little bit. Dug all the muck out of the hole. I didn't break any wood or anything, but there's an old, the bath was still lined in wood.
Mm-hmm.
And then they rebuilt the runway.
Hmm.
I was the first guy to rebuild the runway since 1978.
Oh, wow.
So we spent a couple days up there, just trying to make the footprint what it was in 1978, not trying to make it safer.
Did it just get overgrown or something?
Yeah, it was encroaching from the ends, and it was heavily rutted in the middle. And then there's a drainage ditch on the hill that kind of directed runoff away from it,
mm-hmm.
and that had all grown up. So we tore the vegetative cover off the ditch, and then we utilized small amounts of gravel out of the bottom of the ditch to fill some of the worst chuck holes.
Mm-hmm.
And we just cut a little bit of willows, mostly at either end of the runway, so that when you took off, you didn't clip them.
Right.
And we had a, I think it's still up there, we stripped a four-wheeler down to just the wheels and the engine and flew it up in a 207. And then we had a rake harrow,
mm-hmm.
a chain harrow, and we drove that around to scratch the surface. The intent was to climate change. So the most runways around here grow up in willows because the soil was disturbed,
mm-hmm.
and we were trying to get it to come up in alpine, you know, crowberry kind of vegetation. We thought if we had a turfy, so we were pulling up willows and chopping willows and then places where it was the bottom of the ditch and the and either end of the runway, it was pretty heavy and woody plants, so we just ripped the heck out of it with the chain harrow and put it back, set it back in succession of ways to promote the blueberry, or at least some kind of low vegetation.
Right.
And we didn't really move much gravel. We just did vegetation changes. It lasted several years.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they repeated it because it was an improvement.
Have you flown in on that runway?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen differences from what Charlie is mentioning?
There's a box grader and a chain harrow parked off to the side, or there was when I left.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a...
Yeah,
we used to have to strip the four-wheelers in and out. I don't know if then Bering Air decided they weren't going to fly there anymore, because a near miss.
No.
There's a four-wheeler out there.
Is there?
And I really enjoy walking along, when you walk along the runway, you'll see some of, I think they're the bolete mushrooms.
Yeah.
All lining.
Birch boletes.
And some of them are gigantic. Some of the biggest that I've seen.
Really?
More toward the, you know, the latter part of summer, the later part of summer, I should say.
Yeah, my wife's big into those birch boletes.
Hmm.
Yeah, they're really interesting to...
She merchandise, and I need some both.
I was just going to say they're edible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're good. Mm. We pick them and dry them.
Mm-hmm.
If they're too buggy, she makes dye out of for Kivia dye.
Yes. What color do they dye up into?
Light purpley.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah.
Like your scarf, or maybe a little more purple.
Mauve-y color. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. So we dry a fair amount. We have a dehydrator.
Mm-hmm.
We cut them up into slices and then dry them to not quite potato chip crisp and throw them in the freezer. Pull them out a little bit at a time. Put them in Ziploc bags. You can.
Yep.
You don't have to eat the whole bag at once.
Depending on the size of the bag.
Yeah, I tend to, but yeah, she doesn't. So she yells at me. Yeah.
Well, Charlie, is there anything that we haven't talked about changes in the Seward Peninsula that you think would be important to touch upon?
Oh, just that I'm getting older. No. I don't know. I think transportation, trying to the land is more fragile than it was, in my opinion, and not so much the alpine areas, but the moist tundra places are becoming. Have yet to stabilize, and so I think it's going to be decades before they stabilize. If you read the old books, like when the geologists were here in the early 50s, they named all the Lost Jim and Joan lava flows, and all those were real people in the 1950s. Their stories of doing that field work was walking in super wet tundra. Wet feet day and night and trench foot. And it's not like that now. But the ground's still really soft. And people are high impact and, this ATV and that kind of getting about is pretty rough on the country.
Mm-hmm.
And so very few people walk much anymore. I'm somewhat guilty. I like to walk on the alpine, and there's big stretches of alpine that are pretty much unchanged.
And the sea ice is also more fragile too, from what you've been saying.
Yeah, so that's yes. So in the early 80s, I did my field work through 4 and 5 feet of ice. Today I'm doing field work on 2 feet of ice.
Mm.
And the season is short.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm. So. Katie, did you have any other questions?
I don't think so. No.
Charlie, you've been wonderful. I've learned so much from you. Thank you. Yeah,
thank you.
Yeah.
It's been a real joy to speak with you today.
Thank you.
No, thank you.
Oh, gray hair is good for something, huh?
For a lot of things. Yeah. Turn this off now.
Yeah.